For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. A handful of media conglomerates own most of the media outlets in the United States, controlling the news and information we rely on to make decisions about how we live and work, how we're governed, and informing how we see ourselves and the world. The behemoths that dominate our media landscape are no accident. They are the result of federal policy. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, will soon vote on new rules allowing companies to further monopolize media outlets in the communities they serve, including newspapers, television, radio, and the internet. Critics are calling the impending vote a sort of Christmas present for Rupert Murdoch, who reportedly hopes to add the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune to his U.S. media empire. Michael Copps was a member of the Federal Communications Commission for 10 years, from 2001 to 2011. While at the FCC, he was a strong voice opposing media consolidation and a proponent of local programming and diversity in media ownership. He's now senior advisor for the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to our show, Michael Copps.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be on and talk with you.
And we are privileged to have you join us. Let's start with this proposed rule change at the FCC. What's got public interest advocates like yourself so concerned?
Well, I think both the substance of what they're proposing to do and the process by which they are proposing to do it. The substance is we've had a better part of a generation of more and more media consolidation, as you described at the outset, with fewer and fewer media behemoths gobbling up more and more local, independently run, family-run local stations. And as most of your listeners know, that means program homogenization and commercialization and infotainment replacing investigative journalism. You know, when you go through these big consolidations, they're very costly. The companies are always convinced they will gain all of these efficiencies and economies, but then to show how smart they are to Wall Street so their stock keeps going up, they look around where they can make cuts, and the first place has been the newsroom. So we have been through years now of these transactions, shuttering newsrooms, closing down newsrooms, firing reporters. We've got tens of thousands fewer of investigative reporters. Those reporters are now walking the streets looking for a job rather than walking their beats, uncovering stories and holding the powerful accountable. And the bottom line of that, to make a very long story short, is much less news and what I would call dumbed-down civic dialogue, to the extent where I don't believe we're getting the depth and breadth of information that we need to sustain a viable civic dialogue and to sustain self-government. So that's the substance of it, and we can talk more about why it evolved. Two reasons, basically: all of the private sector consolidation, the mergers and acquisitions driven in the private sector, but the public sector equally, if not more, culpable, because the FCC seldom met a merger that it didn't like, so it blessed most of these transactions. And just as bad, if not worse, beginning in about 1980, what we saw was an evisceration of all the public interest guidelines that broadcasters used to have to observe, or were encouraged to observe, to serve the public interest and maintain competition, localism, and diversity. So it's a public sector partnership that led us to the mess that we are in right now. I usually like those partnerships, but not in this case. And then the process of it is they're doing this not even at an open agenda meeting where the press comes and gets talked about, but they're voting this on circulation in a report that nobody has yet seen. It's called a quadrennial review. Congress mandates a report every 4 years on how the ownership rules are working, and nobody really knows exactly what's in this new report. And the Third Circuit Court had turned down the last couple of efforts the commission made to loosen the media ownership rules, saying that the commission didn't do enough on diversity and it wasn't open and transparent enough. And here we are going straight ahead again for the third time. And the strange thing is that this is happening under a commission with a Democratic majority now. I could understand it when Michael Powell was chairman and Kevin Martin were chairman and under the Bush administration. But I certainly was hoping that things would change when the new commission came to town. I was acting chairman for a while and teed up a lot of these items and had them ready to go, but then since then a new chairman came and we have not had the kind of action on media reform or even credible media oversight under him or under the previous administrations.
I'd like to talk to you about the influence that media lobbies, these big, the media industry has on the FCC. But before we get to that, I wonder if you could tell me to what extent current ownership rules allow a single company to own a newspaper, a television, a cable company, a cable outlet, radio in a given market, and how this rule diverges from that. And maybe you could even start, put us in a historical context and start with the ban on cross-ownership in 1975.
Well, there was a ban instituted on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. There were some waivers given for that. Some companies have were grandfathered just about in perpetuity. Others were given waivers, those that already existed, and some that developed since then, too, these cross-ownership deals, given waivers for a year or two, and then they're expected to sell the second station or sell the newspaper or the broadcast. But the commission has been very generous in extending those waivers and not enforcing the statute and making companies shed themselves of those properties. So the media ownership rules really have been observed more in the breach than anything else. There are statutory limits on the number of radio stations you can own in a market and TV stations, but they've been liberalized. First, there were no duopolies involved. You couldn't own two TV stations, and that eventually went by the board, and attempts have been made to have triopolies where you can own three stations, and each one of those, you have to realize, is each one of those mergers means that you lose a community voice, you lose a different perspective, a different viewpoint. Now, I've never said that all mergers and acquisitions are automatically bad, and I think you can find some places where if a station is going to go dark without some help or something like that and deny all service to the community, where you can maybe understand the need for it. But I think those are few and far between, and I think they need to be looked at on an individual case-by-case basis. Instead, what these redone rules, these new proposals to loosen ownership do is just kind of flash the green light to everything. And that's not the way we need to be going. The way we need to be going is, how do you encourage stations to serve the public interest? They are using a public resource. The airwaves, which belong to the people, is not a broadcaster or a company or a special interest or anybody else that owns an airwave in the United States of America. They belong to the people, and the original deal that was made is you get to be the licensee and the steward of the airwaves if you serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity, which is a term that appears 112 times or thereabouts in the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
Tell us about the Communications Act of 1996. What was the effect of that act on local radio and television stations?
Well, I think not good, but you can't just. There was some loosening. For example, the acts and the way it's been modified allowed the commission to go from a 3-year license period to an 8-year license relicensing period. But if you look at the statute itself, it says the commission can go up to 8 years. So that also means that the commission could go back from 8 years to 5 or 3, and I think that's the direction it needs to go to shorten the license period. It used to be that every 3 years you came in, we had a set of guidelines. I don't make the claim that they were ever enforced very well, but at least they existed. And you could put the license application next to those, and the guidelines would say, are you talking with people in your community about the types of shows they need to see? Are you covering local political events and campaign coverage? Are you covering diverse cultures that have some limitations on excessive advertising and things like that? Those have all been eviscerated and eradicated and no longer exist, those guidelines. And in the meantime, we said, oh, by the way, instead of doing your license every 3 years, just send in a postcard every 8 years and you'll get the license renewed. And it's so curious, really, when you stop and think about it, because back when the local, when the station was owned locally, the president of the broadcasting station in a community lived there, and he went to the barbershop, he or she went to the bakery, the grocery store, the beauty parlor, you name it. But still, we required them to make sure that they were going out, talking to members of their community about the kinds of programming they would be interested in seeing in that community. It was called ascertainment. Now, fast forward, the owner may live, you know, several hundred miles or a couple of thousand miles away, has no ties with the community, and we don't ask for any outreach like that. It's all just left to the station and the bottom line business mentality that seems to drive just about everything right now. So yes, the act partly responsible, but much more than that, the regulations of the commission. The commission tomorrow, on its own authority, could put out a set of public interest guidelines saying, and, you know, I talked a lot at the beginning about news and the paucity of news. Just one of those guidelines could be, what are you doing on news? Are you investing more money in news coverage? One of them could be, are you really going out and talking to members of your community about programming? Are you reflecting the different cultures in your community? Do you have a public safety plan? So if there's a hurricane or an act of terror or whatever it is, that 24/7, you're ready to go. You all remember that famous case out in Minot where a train carrying poisonous gas flipped over some years ago, and they couldn't find anybody on the radio station, which just kept playing music while the whole community was being threatened with life-threatening injuries. So you have a public safety plan, too. Those are the kind of things. And I'm not advocating, you know, really rigorous oversight and taking licenses away right and left or anything like that. But I think if we had a shorter license period and we had some public interest guidelines and you picked out one or two of the really egregiously bad actors and maybe put them on probation for a year or so, I think the word would go forth very quickly that the FCC was back in the business of protecting the public interest. And I think you'd see broadcasters straightening out their acts real well. Let me also say I'm not indicting all broadcasters. I think there's a lot of, especially the ones who have managed to survive as independent, sometimes family-owned broadcasters through the generations, smaller outfits in whose breast the public interest flame still burns. But it's just harder and harder for them to be captains of their own fate. More and more are they captive to the unforgiving expectations of the marketplace. And, you know, if you made 10% this year, you got to make 15 the next year. And if you make 15 the next year, you got to make 20 after that. And it's awful hard to serve the public interest and do that too. And but that's one of the prices you pay for industrial consolidation and letting Wall Street basically dictate what you're going to be doing.
Can you The FCC itself claims that deregulation, I guess, which started, I guess it's started in earnest in the 1990s, that deregulation increases competition by removing so-called barriers to entry into the market. In the 1990s, we had the entry of cable companies, for example. Back in the old days, before the internet, before cable, the three television networks already had a monopoly. What do you say to the casual observer who says that there are more sources of news, information, and entertainment now than there were, say, in 1960, particularly concerning television?
Well, maybe more stations, maybe more puppets, but fewer ventriloquists. If you've got lots of different outlets putting out the very same news, if you have two stations in one city, that are using the same newsroom, then you're not getting that antagonistic clash of viewpoints that the First Amendment demands. In a way, I've heard people say this before about, well, look how much better things are now than they were back in the 50s and 60s. But, you know, if you go back in that time, even though we had only the three networks at that period of time, we had a lot more newspapers, for example, probably triple or quadruple. We had no networks owning and operating local stations. They operated a network that made programming available. We had financial syndication rules so that the people who produced shows weren't the same people who distributed shows. We had those public interest guidelines I talked about before, the three-year license period, and the broadcasters even had a code of voluntary conduct back at that time, which is more than the code of voluntary conduct that they have right now. So, you know, it wasn't, it's not that much of a difference qualitatively wise. You could probably make the argument you had even more news back back then. I remember watching when I was a young lad network news on our little black and white 7-inch television set, and John Cameron Swayze or Doug Edwards would come in with the 15-minute news every night. And we all think now about how quaint that is, but then you stop and think that John Cameron Swayze had a bureau in London, a bureau in Paris, a bureau in Rome, a bureau in Bonn, a bureau in Tokyo, bureaus all over the world. Now the networks have gotten rid of a lot of those bureaus. The only outfit that really has a lot of bureaus overseas is NPR, National Public Radio. And what you see on the network news usually is maybe a stringer that you've never seen before. You don't know how well-versed he or she is in the news or what kind of biases they bring. So we've lost a lot. Now, some people listening to you at this point are probably saying, yeah, but he's talking about, you know, radio and TV and cable, and we've got new media now, so what difference does it make? New media is going to replace old media. We're all moving to the Internet. But the fact of the matter is that new media has not developed a business model, a model to sustain the investigative journalism that has been lost in old media. And believe it or not, the experts tell us that 90 to 95% of the news that we read, even on the Internet, 90 to 95% of that still originates where? In the television broadcast newsroom or the newspaper newsroom. And the problem is there's so much less of that news in the newspaper and broadcast TV rooms. So that's a problem. We have wonderful new opportunities with the Internet. There are exciting experiments going on there, wonderful entrepreneurship. But from the standpoint of figuring out how do you really have that depth of investigating journalism you need, not so much. You know, it used to be in the newspaper world, Ben Bradley or somebody like that could say to his reporters about Woodward and all, go devote yourself to a story for 6 months or a year. You don't have to do anything else but dig in, hold the powerful accountable. And that went on in so many different areas. And there's not as much of that left anymore because that doesn't generate an immediate return. So you ask yourself every day, what stories aren't being told today? What powerful person is getting away with something shouldn't be getting away with? And if we had a more vigilant media, why are there so few reporters covering state houses, for example? So much stuff is going on in state houses. Most state houses have probably five times more lobbyists than they have reporters covering them. And this is where so much of the action is going on that has changed the laws in our land. I don't want to go off on this right now, but, you know, there's something called the American Legislative Exchange Council that has been active for 30 or 40 years.
We've covered that, sure.
Yeah, well, that's quite a story, and it went basically, you know, I've been working in this town for 40 years, and I didn't hear of ALEC until a couple of years ago, and all the while they're in passing all this, well, not passing, but writing all this legislation that they then get compliant legislators to introduce. And
that's on the state level, isn't it?
Yes, and voter suppression, and in this area we're talking about here, in telecommunications, prohibiting states, 19 states have now been prohibited by their state legislatures from allowing municipal broadband. So when AT&T and Verizon don't want to go in and serve an area, and the community says, well, we'll build our own broadband, these states preclude it. That's thanks to the big telephone companies who are members of ALEC doing all of this.
I didn't know that. The FCC has also claimed that there's no significant evidence that media ownership influences viewpoint. Now, you were an insider at the FCC for 10 years. I assume the agency considers all kinds of studies and does its own analyses, and et cetera, and also listens to public comments, presumably, as well as corporate lobbyists. So what do you say to
I say don't you think that Rupert Murdoch owning Fox Television has anything to do with the viewpoint?
Well, sure, and reportedly he wants to add the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune to his media empire. And would this rule allow he owns television stations in that area? Is this rule going to open that particular door for him?
It's a complicated thing because the he owns them now, and the Tribune Company has waivers, like for Chicago and all. So it's kind of a open question, and it wouldn't be a slam dunk, I don't think. For me, it would be if I was still a member of the Federal Communications Commission. I would say, no way at all that we should allow that. But you know, you'd have to convince five commissioners there and what their disposition would be. I would certainly hope it would be one of skepticism. Here we have a company whose owner has been deemed not to be really fit in Great Britain to own everything he does there. And, you know, there's some speculation that maybe maybe because they're a little bit on the defense in Great Britain, that they'll be lowering their presence there and maybe looking for other places to invest. He's already got Wall Street Journal and New York newspapers, other newspapers around the country, and Fox. So I think allowing the Los Angeles Times and Tribune to come under that control would be an even worse situation than we have right now.
So what accounts for, now you just pointed out a few minutes ago that now we have a majority of commissioners who are Democrats, and they are now pushing through this rule. We have the current chairman appointed by he was appointed by President Obama.
Absolutely.
Right? And yet these kinds of rules are still being pursued. This kind of policy is still being pursued. Yeah. How much of this is due to, how much of policymaking at the FCC is a response to technological change that you've been describing, and how much is due to political influence of the industry that's being regulated, and how's that exercised?
It's a couple of different questions why the current chairman thinks as he does. You know, I'd have to let him speak for himself. I think he's very focused on broadband, has done some good things to develop a broadband strategy for the country and wireless and all of that. So those have seemed to be priority objects in his mind, and maybe underneath he really thinks that having some consolidation would be good. Better to have some news than no news, and if he sees it all disappearing, maybe that's where that comes from. On the more general question of industry influence, it's huge on Capitol Hill, at the FCC. The broadcasters can walk in anytime. They've got the resources. They can file lengthy legal documents and research their own research whenever they want. Money is no object to that. This is a time in our society when the impact of big money, I think, is as great as it has ever been throughout the course of American history. I used to teach American history even in the days of the Gilded Age, excuse me, back in the late 1990s. I don't think it had any greater influence than it has now. It's outrageous, and the country has to, we have to do something about it, and this is not the lone example by any stretch of the imagination, but it's so important. Again, it's a public resource, and again, it's the home of our civic dialogue, and the quality of that will have a lot to do whether we survive as a viable country and get out of the mess that we're in right now, and we face, as you know, terribly serious problems. So it's time to start saying no to some of this consolidation. It's time to reassert the public interest. Time to have some guidelines for broadcasters, and time to take a serious look at what's the future of the civic dialogue as we transfer radio and TV over the years to the Internet. And we don't want to regulate the Internet, obviously. We do want to make sure we have an open Internet so it doesn't go down the same road of consolidation as newspapers and broadcast and radio and cable did. There are signs that it's going down that very same road right now. And wouldn't that be the tragedy of our times, of this most opportunity-creating technology since the printing press, able to open up to opportunity and education and jobs and health opportunities and everything for so many people? If we allowed that to become a cableized Internet, I mean, there would be no excuse for that.
We'll be joined in a little bit later in the broadcast by Joseph Torres of Free Press, and hopefully we can expand a little bit on those comments.
Very good. Joe is excellent, a wonderful observer and a good writer about all this, so I'm delighted you'll be talking to him.
Yes. Okay, this is the last question. We're about out of time. We're operating here. This program is operating from a non-commercial radio station belonging to Boston College. There are a handful of college radio stations in Boston that encourage community radio broadcasts like this one, producing original and diverse content. What do you think the most effective thing that we and our listening public can do is that we can do to affect FCC policy?
I think in the final analysis, real reform is going to come from some grassroots pressure, and that's why I have after I retired, joined forces with Common Cause, which has offices all around the country and members, more importantly, all around the country. Members of Congress, decision makers generally, the state and local officials have to hear from their citizens the concern of this. And that still makes a difference. Even in this day of the outrageous control of so much by so few, I've seen citizen action work. When Michael Powell tried to loosen the media ownership rules back in 2003, I think they thought it was pretty much an inside-the-beltway issue that nobody cared about. But my colleague, Jonathan Adelstein, Commissioner Adelstein, and I went to held and attended hearings around the country, held by a lot of public interest groups, Common Cause, Free Press, a bunch of others, community organizations. And as a result of that, this was back before the Internet was really full speed ahead, 3 million people contacted the FCC and Congress and said that we don't like those rules, and the Senate voted twice to overturn them. And the House expressed its displeasure, and then the court sent them back. But I saw lots of senators and congressmen after that who said, you know, I went home to a town hall meeting, and somebody raised their hand and asked me a question about media ownership. He said, I never knew that that was an issue in my district or in my state. So once they know, then they respond. So do these programs. Talk to your friends and colleagues. Write op-eds, contact people in positions of responsibility, write a poem, sing a song, do whatever. It's that important. I don't think there's any issue any more important than sustaining our civic dialogue and having a good, fact-filled discussion of the issues that face us. And we're not having that on a lot of these issues, and that's why the country hasn't made good decisions on a lot of them over the years.
Thank you for joining us, Michael Copps. It was a privilege to have you join us today here.
Privilege to be on your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. I've been speaking with Michael Copps, a former member of the Federal Communications Commission and now the senior advisor for the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.